This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and signature support for our show is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number is 877-217-5757, and email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Marvin Broom, the first gentleman of East Baton Rouge Parish, and Marvin Broom is a guy of many interests. In addition to being the husband of Sharon Weston Broom, he's an accomplished chef, he's an accomplished photographer, and for 23 years, he taught English at Allen Hall at LSU, and 17 years prior to that at Texas A&M. So he's a man of letters in addition to his many other pursuits. And good morning to you, first gentleman, Marvin Broom.
Well, good morning, Jim, and thank you so much for inviting me here. Good morning to your listeners as well. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Honor to be with you. 877-217-5757 for the first gentleman who, of course, has to take the slings and arrows that his wife gets as the mayor president. And it's not an easy position to be sometimes, but nonetheless, the family of Baton Rouge, the first family, seems to be thriving, and it's 6.5 years into this noble endeavor. And when you move to Baton Rouge to marry Sharon Weston, yeah, I suspect you never dreamt it would turn out like this.
I had no clue, Jim, what I was getting into. I was, working at that small Texas town, Bryan College Station, and sort of isolated from politics all in all, and particularly Louisiana politics. And so when a friend of ours introduced me to Sharon and we got married, and I moved to Baton Rouge and was impressed by the university, was impressed by how friendly the people were, people are here in town. And the greenery here, you know, that was just something I hadn't seen in such a long time. So it was an easy decision to move from Bryan College Station to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. But no, I did not know, you know, the extent of her popularity, if you will, until I moved here. And I remember the first time I was surprised by it. We were at I think we drove through one of those, fast food drive-thrus, and Sharon ordered something. And then when she came to the window to pick up, the whole crew was staring out of the window going, "There she is, there she is." And I was like, "Man, what did I get into here?" So, yeah, it's been interesting.
And we've had you on, and you and the mayor and your daughter, Sarah. And of course, your story has been told on this show, but it's enough of a fascinating account to repeat. But your first wife died. You met her in Germany.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then shortly thereafter, you met Sharon, and you had to do some wooing, but ultimately you married her.
Yeah, well, that's so true. And my part of the story is that wooing part. It only took actually a year once I met her, and a year and 2 days later we were married. So we had a very strong letter writing campaign, and we were both mature individuals
That's great. So you were writing letters to her. Was she reciprocating?
Yes, we wrote letters
to
each other.
That's just not done much anymore.
No, not at all. And it was really, you know, there in plain and clear, her values, and so that was the sweet part about it.
And she had never married.
No. First time being married, and she was a courageous woman, not having been married before, and had three kids, husband.
You're three, yeah.
All three kids.
Who all were young.
Yes, Sarah, my daughter was, she was a freshman in high school, and my youngest son was a third or fourth grader, and my oldest son was a freshman in college, so they were younger
people. So she took on a lot.
She did. Mm-hmm. She did, especially taking on the young lady who was Sarah, who was in after the death of her mom, she took over the matriarch position in the family, and then Sharon came along, there was this friction for a long time. And it's amazing, you know, how that stamina that both of them had to hang in there with each other, and how they have just become such strong friends now with each other. And I'm the outside guy, so it's really, really, but it's lovely, lovely to see the mutual respect that they have for each other now. It's really great. That's something about blending families that's really took place there, and it was really, really wonderful experience in the end, how we all, you know, worked our way through that process. It was really great.
Took some time, though. Mm-hmm. But Sarah's now a successful lawyer, and your two sons, they're living outside of Baton Rouge.
They live outside of Baton Rouge. The oldest son now lives in Richmond, Virginia, and he's in IT. He calls himself a cloud architect or something of that nature. And my youngest son spent some time in the AmeriCorps. Some years in AmeriCorps, but he now has enrolled in law school in Chicago. So he's in studying law there.
And they all came to Baton Rouge a few months ago on March 17th for the 75th birthday of Marvin.
75 years
old.
In
addition to everything else, you robbed the cradle. Your wife is a decade younger than
you. She is indeed.
But it's worked out well. And you also said, if I remember right on this show, that you've only kissed two women in your life, and you married both of them.
That's true. That's true. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Yes.
It's a good story.
Yeah. Yeah. There was something, I don't know what's the source of it all, but it was something that I felt was really important to me. And I think it's important to, it was just my philosophy that I believed that I had something special to give to my wife, and I wanted to reserve all of that for the person that I was going to marry, and so that's kind of where I stood, and I'm that way. I feel the same now. I think people have a different philosophy about that these days. I feel that both men and women are willing to, if you will, go very far, very early to woo their partner. And I think they do it too soon in a lot of cases.
Well, we have, of course, a lot of divorce, and for various reasons. And sometimes people just grow apart.
That's true. That's true.
Sounds like you and the mayor, despite having different lifestyles, I mean, she's really in the public eye. You're a teacher. That's a public job, but not like that.
True.
Not like being an office holder.
That's true. That's true. And those two lifestyles, you know, they might not appear to be similar, but you know, we're still addressing, you know, a group of people that sometimes we don't know. And we have to, you know, demonstrate leadership and ability to communicate.
Well.
And so those are some of the things that we have in common. So, but for me, it wasn't necessarily the different lifestyle. It was something that my wife did, and I saw that she was indeed happy doing that. And my responsibility as her partner is to support her and ensure that she's, you know, do my part to ensure that she's successful at it. And, you know, that's my responsibility as a husband.
Yeah. Well, in the last year since you were on this show, you know, some of the criticism has intensified, particularly on crime. And a mayor, any politician for that matter, can only do so much. A politician has a hard time correcting what's going on in Brookstown, for example. It's not a one-person job. It takes a village.
Sure.
And it's going to take some time.
Yeah,
and we've been saying that for years. But the mayor is the person at the top, the old buck stops here mantra. Yeah. It's got to hurt you, and I would think, when she gets criticized for things that you feel that are unwarranted.
Yeah. Well, Jim, we try as much as we can to isolate ourselves from the criticisms. And so we're not on social media reading, you know, what people are saying, on Facebook about us, and we're not listening to talk shows to, you know, to monitor what's being said. Sharon has a team of people that, you know, that monitor that media, and if there's something that she needs to know, then they will share it with her. But surely they don't bring negative, make it negative news to her about he say she say kind of stuff. So that's the buffer, and then that's how we stand.
Well, we'll have another segment with Marvin Broom, the first gentleman of Baton Rouge. He recently retired at LSU. We'll talk more about that when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And another segment with the first gentleman of Baton Rouge, Marvin Broom. And Marvin Broom's a man of many pursuits, and he was in the U.S. Army for 8 years, served abroad mostly in Germany, trained at Fort Benning in Georgia. Sergeant Broom met his wife in Germany and three children. His wife died of cancer, and then a year later he married Sharon Weston Broom. He met her in College Station, Texas. Somebody must have set that meeting up, huh?
Yes, and actually it was 2 years after my first wife passed away that Sharon and I met.
And then 1 year after that. So yes, 3 years from.
Yes, indeed.
Well, and you taught 17 years at Texas A&M and then 23 years at LSU.
LSU, yeah.
And on some of my walks, of course, there's no better place to walk than the LSU campus. And occasionally I'll actually go in buildings that I used to inhabit when I was a student. Mm-hmm. One of those is Allen Hall. And lo and behold, I'm walking through Allen Hall and I see a lineup of all the professors, and there's Kevin Cope, frequent guest, Talk Louisiana, and right next to Kevin Cope, Marvin Broom.
Yes.
It is smiling face.
Yes. I think I was about 60 pounds lighter when I moved here, but the food is great here, and I enjoy cooking, and I enjoy eating, and it's quite different. But
How was the experience as a teacher at LSU?
Oh man, it was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. There was such a variety of courses that I could teach there that was not available to me at Texas A&M. A&M was mostly, it's an engineering school, mechanical schools, and so they were like technical writing, just give me the basics, and that was it. And I came to LSU and there was more a broad variety of topics that I could teach on. And so I taught African-American studies. I taught intro to African-American studies there. I had lots of football players in my classes. I taught linguistics, Black English vernacular is a course I taught and really enjoyed. And I really sort of focused in on the impact of language, the impact of culture on writing. And so I really got involved in combining those two things, culture, language, and writing, and how culture influenced writing. So that was really kind of how I got into moving from the classroom into mentoring mm-hmm. predominantly grad students. And their endeavors to write their dissertation or writing their theses, things of that nature. Also, then I helped mentor undergraduate students as well, particularly students who were interested in becoming teachers themselves. Mm-hmm. And so,
I know it's a big topic, but how does culture influence writing?
Well, language and culture influence the way one thinks and approaches a situation, and so that will vary according to the culture there. In American culture, for the most part, you can see the difference in a lot of cases, you know, how male females approach a subject You can see, for an example, how folks in Arabic speaking countries, or how folks in the East, for an example, Chinese or Japanese, and their approach and their life's philosophy will influence how they approach writing. If you look at, for an example, someone, let's say someone from Brazil writing, you know, a dissertation. American writing and American academic writing, we want you to go straight to the point and get to the point. And in some of those other countries, it's okay to, you know, to allude to the point you're trying to get rather than stating it directly out.
When sometimes the writing is more interesting when you do it the other way.
Indeed. It's more interesting. But
that's not the way we do things.
That's not American academic writing. They want you to just leave the interest. Just give me the facts. Let's get straight to the
potatoes,
point.
Meat and potatoes, yeah.
Yes. And with those other, you know, some of those other languages, some of those other cultures, it's okay to pontificate, to, you know, to go on a tangent and just to demonstrate that you... Mm-hmm. You know, indeed, our material for a PhD,
all right,
for example.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org. And it is Heather in Goodwood asking your favorite writers. Do you have some favorites?
Yes, I enjoy Zeta Elliott. She's a youth and young adult writer. And I really enjoy that. I enjoy writers, from the Harlem Renaissance. I enjoy Zora Neale Hurston, for an example. And I really like her language because Zora Neale Hurston, of course, grew up in Florida, and the language that she uses is very, very close to the language that I grew up speaking. So I really fell in love with her writing. So it's really cool.
You have an accent. Some people mm-hmm. probably think you were raised in another part of the world.
Yes, yes.
How did you cultivate your accent?
Man, that's really, I have no clue. But I do tell you that when I moved to Germany, I did speak Black English. You know, when I moved there, I spoke my mother's tongue. And an attempt to, when speaking English to, you know, to internationals, I wanted to... I want to make myself understood, and so I subconsciously dropped some of the language that I grew up speaking and spoke in a manner that I thought they would understand, and whatever sounds I created, they understood, and so those are the ones I held on to. I also at the University of Tübingen, where I studied at in Germany. There were 25,000 students there, and I discovered over a period of 1 or 2 years there were just 8 Black people, you know, studying there, and I was just one of those eight.
Yeah.
Out of 25,000, and the rest of those guys were from the African continent, and so I spent a lot of time with those students as well, and I think I might have picked up some of that, some of their accents as well.
Sounds like your experience in Germany was a big part of your formative years as a professional.
Absolutely. I was there, you know, growing up into manhood, if you will. I was in my early 20s when I arrived in Germany, and from 20s to my 30s, you know, for the most part, that's mm-hmm. where I sort of grew up into manhood. And so that indeed, you know, had an impact on how I view the world, impact on how I, you know, how I see the world, my Weltanschauung.
Okay, here's Whitney saying that, reflecting on a previous appearance, you were educated at Penn State after you came back, right?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, Penn State, Texas A&M, LSU. Can you compare the three?
Oh, man. So those are different phases. There was a different phases of my life when I, you know, after being in Germany for, man, almost 10 years living in Germany and then coming back to the United States, it was a culture shock. And I really am happy that I went to Happy Valley, if you will, you know, coming back to the United States and spending my first time there. And because it helped me to reacculturate myself into this country. And then moving to Texas A&M was another phase of my life, and more as a really as a professional, and just getting acquainted to working, you know, in an American society. And also I became really interested in what it was, you know, for undergraduate students here in the United States and how they went about learning in contrast to studying in Germany. And so that was a phase that was really interesting. Football, though, was a thing, and LSU is really number one in my life, based on the number of games that I went to see it in. So, well, yes.
What a game it'll be September 10th, LSU against Southern. I have a feeling the mayor might be there on 10th of September. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Marvin Broom. Then it's Mark Ballard after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Just a few minutes away from our visit on Thursdays with Mark Ballard, who has much to opine about as the world is evolving, not only in Baton Rouge, but in the Beltway. And Mark is always at the ready. But 877-217-5757. I apologize. Chad and Lafayette had been waiting a little while. I was going to get you in, Chad. If you can call back very quickly, we'll try to get your question in for Marvin Broom, the first gentleman. But another listener asked about those three campuses. You were on some big campuses. I mean, huge campuses. Bigger than both of them. By the way, NM and Penn State are both bigger than LSU. But of the three, Happy Valley, College Station, Baton Rouge, prettiest campus?
Man, I would say that LSU is really my number one as far as beauty and the architecture of the campus. Penn State really impressed me with the different plants that they have on campus, and whether it's in the middle of the winter and winter temperature average in the it's like 40 degrees below zero on average. And so you can find plants in bloom even, you know, during that time on campus, and there's always something that catches your attention when it comes to, you know, to their landscape architecture. It was really beautiful campus from that perspective. 100,000 people, you know, in the stadium was the first time I've been in a stadium that big. It was just very, very impressive. And I don't, now when I look back at it, I don't see how they could cram, you know, 100,000 people into that small town, you know, College Station with what is that, 20,000 people there on average or something.
And of course, it's a slightly bigger stadium than is Tiger Stadium. Mm-hmm. Chad and Lafayette, please be brief. You're on with Marvin Broom. Hi, Chad.
Hi, y'all. I just wanted to thank y'all for this morning. I also had a question for the professor. I'm a recent graduate of Dilley University, and I was just wondering if he had any issues with people questioning his legitimacy in academia or his work because of his race or ethnicity.
Yes, indeed. Sure. When I arrived at LSU, that was something that I had to deal with. I think at the beginning of every, I know, I didn't have to think, and it was something that I dealt with at the beginning of every semester. There were a lot of students who never, you know, had a black person as their instructor or as a teacher before, and particularly as an English teacher, then that was always a challenge. But, you know, that's for me, that was the norm. I do not think, and also there mm-hmm. were colleagues that questioned that as well. But you know what? I sort of since I've been in the military, I've sort of been in those positions as the only black person, you know, at the table, and to have them question my legitimacy is something that I've, you know, dealt with my entire life. So that's not something that sort of was new or caught my attention. It's just part of being an African American male in reality, or being an African American in general.
Well, thank you for being part of our community, and best to you and the mayor and your family.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marvin Broom. 877-217-5757. We turn the page, and it's Mark Ballard time. It is Thursday, and We're going to cover a few stories with him, but this is the New York Times. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, weighed whether she should vote to take up a bipartisan gun reform measure. The phone lines in her office were being flooded by constituents. The calls were coming in 6-1, she estimated, with an urgent message, please do something. And on Tuesday, Senator Ernst became one of 14 Republicans. Bill Cassidy was one of the others, to break with her party to support moving ahead with the legislation, propelling it past a Republican blockade that has thwarted years of efforts to overhaul the nation's gun laws. The vote was an indication of how lawmakers in both political parties have been galvanized to action by the horror of back-to-back mass shootings, including a racist massacre that killed 10 black people in Buffalo and a rampage 4 weeks ago at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, that killed 19 children and two teachers. Mark Ballard, interesting that Senator Cassidy voted yes to advance this. Senator Kennedy voted no. Kennedy's up for re-election. And then, of course, if this clears the Senate, it's got a House vote, and all indications are every member of our delegation will vote no, except Troy Carter. Gun safety, gun control, gun regulation, whatever you want to call it, is a tough sell in Louisiana, at least among lawmakers who represent us. Your thoughts?
Well, that is true. It's guns are important in Louisiana, and our representatives are not going to vote against that. It was interesting to point out that New York Times article also pointed out that that most of the senators who were doing were favoring the advancing the gun safety bill. Basically, were not up for re-election, and so they did so without having to face their electorate.
But 14 Republicans is a significant number, all 50 Democrats, 34 Republicans saying no way, anytime, don't even go there, and John Kennedy, one of them. It's an 80-page bill, which really is more cosmetic than reality, but it's at least a start. It's called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. It would enhance background checks. It would give authorities up to 10 business days to review their juvenile and mental health records of gun purchasers younger than 21, and direct millions toward helping states implement so-called red flag laws, which allow authorities to temporarily confiscate guns from people deemed dangerous, as well as other intervention programs. So the measure also, for the first time, would ensure that serious dating partners are included in a federal law that bars domestic abusers from purchasing firearms, a longtime priority that has eluded gun safety advocates for years. So maybe I'm being wrong in saying that it's more cosmetic. There are some substantial things in the bill, but it doesn't ban assault weapons, for example. It doesn't lower the age for purchase, or raise the age of purchase, rather, to 21. Mark Ballard, it would seem that something like this is more common sense than anything else, but the gun lobby is extremely powerful, and when it comes time to vote in the House, I suspect Congressman Graves, Congressman Scalise, Johnson, Letlow, Higgins, they'll all vote the other way, meaning no, as they did on a gun bill that cleared the House a few days ago.
Yeah, I think that they will vote as they did on the House bill that came out. And in large part, these gun lobbies hold a lot of sway in Louisiana because they are kind of a shorthand, like a bumper sticker saying, you know, I'm pro Second Amendment, you know, so that they don't actually have to do much more than support the lobbies. And I think that we're going to see that. We're going to see that in Louisiana. The legislation, I kind of think of it as window dressing, but it does do a couple of things. But it's, for the most part, not really addressing people who buy these guns with high magazines going into theaters and schools and shooting people.
877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard. David in Atlanta, you're up. David, good morning, sir.
Jim, you and Mark are correct. MSNBC reported a short time ago Steve Scalise is whipping his Republican colleagues into voting against the gun safety bill, and that is totally nauseating to me. You know, the Democrat who ran against the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has been indicted for raising money and diverting the money for another cause. And he's under federal criminal indictment for wire fraud. How long is it going to take the feds to indict Donald Trump for essentially carrying out the same scam?
All right. Well, there is a parallel there. David, of course, is not on the Trump train. We know that. But according to reports from the 1-6 committee, Donald Trump raised a whole lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars for his defense of what he viewed as the election integrity, and then didn't use the money for that purpose, according to those in the know. That's what they say. So you would think there might be some criminal exposure, but we shall see. And Mark, I don't know. I just think that a lot of prosecutors, as we saw in New York, they don't have the stomach to go after a former president. It's just something that would divide our country. And prosecutors are not supposed to look at the political implications, but sometimes they do.
Well, they also need to have ironclad cases. And in many of these cases, it's not as ironclad as they would like to see, particularly in the scenario which you rightly point out, because it would split the country. So, I mean, are they going to go after? I wonder if the Attorney General is going to pick up on the findings from the January 6th Commission in the U.S. House. But I guess that'll give us an idea of whether they're serious about going after the President Trump and what he did for leading up into the January 6th insurrection.
It's Patrick in Innisfail. Patrick, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I know y'all kind of haven't gotten to this subject yet, but y'all said you were going to talk about it. Election fraud. Is there any maybe attempt to put cameras and recording devices on election workers, you know, like we do with police officers? Maybe have a camera and we can record conversations so that if the audit ever has to be done of an election, I'm talking about the ballot counters. That's what I'm talking about, like people that count the ballots and stuff. I think it'd be good to have cameras and recording devices on them while they're counting the ballots.
Well, in Louisiana, we have largely electronic machines. Are some paper ballots, but Mark, this has not been an issue until now, and it's an issue in a race that was not close. There would have to be a whole lot of election fraud. I mean, gobs and gobs and gobs of it, and all on one side, for Donald Trump to have won this election. And it's bizarre that many people have bought into this. Patrick may be one of them, but if we can do anything to clear the air, I'm all for that. But we're going to go to a few other topics with Mr. Mark Ballard, Man About Town, after this quick pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And if you have something on your mind, Mark Ballard is the man at the ready right now. Your number is 877-217-5757. A topic that some listeners have asked Mark to opine about is the so-called three-month break on federal gas taxes that President Biden is advocating. He's getting some pushback in Congress to the point where it may not happen, including his own party. Even the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, says this would largely be a benefit for oil companies, not for consumers. But nonetheless, with fuel prices at record highs, the president urged Congress to temporarily suspend the federal gas tax and give Americans a little bit of breathing room, as he puts it. In a speech from the White House, President Biden asked Congress to lift the federal taxes, 18 cents per gallon, 24 cents per gallon for diesel, through the end of September. Be about $10 billion a hole in the federal budget, but Biden has reduced the deficit that he inherited from $2.7 trillion to $1 trillion. But as you can imagine, Republicans pounced on the Democratic president, and it's odd for these Republicans, who are usually in favor of any kind of tax reduction, to pound away. But Garrett Graves is one of them, saying that white smoke was visible from the White House chimney. They'd found another gimmick. The Biden administration is so determined to rob Peter to pay Paul, but their decisions are so stupid they can't even figure out they are Peter. That's from Garrett Graves, who is not a college graduate, attacking Syracuse Law School graduate, Joseph Robinette Biden, who graduated 76 in a class of 85. But nonetheless, a lot of hyperbole out there, Mark.
Indeed. And it's hard to come up with an argument that this is not political from President Biden's point of view and being taken advantage of politically by the Republicans who oppose him. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that the folks have been blaming the president for the high gas prices, but that's the way it is when you're, in the hot seat. And I think that's what he's having to deal with. If they did the federal taxes, I think that's what, about 14, 15 cents per gallon that it would decrease?
18
cents per gallon?
18.
Okay, so it would decrease it, but not, wouldn't be getting under the $4 level.
It is a symbolic move more than anything else, but sometimes symbolism is a good thing. And as I stated, the previous president was running a country with $1.7 trillion more in hot checks than the current president. So if it costs $10 billion, that's got to go a long way to get to $1.7 trillion. So he has shown more economic restraint than did his predecessor. Here's a story our news director, Jeff Palermo, at the Louisiana Radio Network just sent me. It says, in a show of support for all Republican legislators and their legislation, the Louisiana Conservative Caucus is calling for a veto override session to correct the governor's unilateral actions. This year, the governor has vetoed legislation ranging from religious freedom and personal liberty to criminal justice reform and special needs education. Members of the Conservative Caucus asking for all House and Senate colleagues to join in calling a veto override session. And that, of course, one of the leaders is Jack McFarland, Republican from Winfield. He's the chair. And, Mark, you think this will happen?
Right now I'm not thinking that it's a possibility. I've talked to enough of the legislators who say that they're not really into it. There is, from the far right, and of which we have a number of legislators who are there and are saying that they would like to have an override session, and they're getting a lot of pressure from the grassroots groups saying that they need to override session for this bill or that one, and particularly the vaccination bills. But I don't think that may be happening. But then, that and $4 will get you coffee at Starbucks. So we'll find out in a few weeks.
877-217-5757. Still time to get in under the wire with Mark Ballard. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, guests. Just a quick note. Gas in Opelousas, two places, 409 and 419. Just putting that out there. We've seen a lot of production. Mm-hmm. I was going to all honor it. A lot of everybody doing all the production they can. So supply is coming up. Prices going down. Just the law of finance.
Well, I tell you, it is hard to accept $4 a gallon gas. But I was in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, Mark, and rented a car and fill it back up before I returned it. $6.40 a gallon. $6.40 a gallon. So we should be appreciative that we don't have it as bad as the folks in the great state of California right now.
Well, yeah, I think our gas prices are actually kind of lower than many around the country. So, but then we have more of the refineries here. From what I've been reading is that this gas price increase has come about because the refineries are not running at as full production as they could. They're still getting their feet back after the pandemic. And Russia, the war and the Russian war in Ukraine has put a lot of pressure on the price per price per barrel for oil because, we're not taking their oil, as it were. But all of this is, you have to look at the other way, and that is Louisiana depends a large part of its budget and the revenues that come in on the price of price per barrel. And so it's actually pretty good for Louisiana as far as the price per barrel goes and the taxes that are raised on that.
It does help the state coffers. There is a plus to rising gas prices. And we saw this in the late 70s when the rest of the country during the Carter years was suffering and Louisiana was blossoming and booming and Edwin Edwards was counting his money. It is a bizarre but understandable turn of events. And on the whole, I think we'd rather have lower gas prices. A listener does point out, though, that one of the reasons why Louisiana has lower costs per gallon is that our state taxes are so low that California has a much higher state tax on gasoline.
And that is true. In fact, it comes up almost every year in the legislature because the money that we get from those state taxes are kind of directed into maintaining our roads. And so there it is.
All right. Another listener notes about the 1-6 commission, which will convene again today. And it is a Republican, Liz Cheney, who's becoming the star. But my guess, and this is getting to the listener's question, is that our delegation will not even acknowledge this is going on. And if they do, they probably won't speak highly of it. Your thoughts?
I think that's the narrative that's being pushed by the House Republicans and in particular by the minority whip, Steve Scalise. And so, yeah, they're not going to be making much comment on it, but it seems like most of the witnesses are Republicans, and most of the points being made against President Trump and his supporters are being made by Republicans. So I'm wondering how long it's going to be before there'll be a shift in the thought process there.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Mark.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Jim. That gun bill was basically written by the NRA lobbyists, and I have to say there's no way that having more good guys with guns solves this problem. There were a lot of good guys with guns who basically could not go in and save those children.
Well that I'm not really following what you're saying regarding this bill. It's silent on a lot of things. It doesn't really encourage people to go buy more guns, but it enables them to. There's no doubt that it doesn't do a lot to stem the huge amount of firearms we have in our country. Mark, it is.
I think that was what his point was: is that it does something, and it's good to see that something was done, but it doesn't do anything that addresses active shooters, and I think that's. That's an issue that a lot of people are, upset about. You know, I don't know how I would react if one of my children were killed in elementary school, but it wouldn't be good.
So. Yeah, and I recall when Daniel Pearl, the journalist, was beheaded, he was killed on the job. There is a difference. Death is death, but there is a difference between killing somebody in one way and killing them in another. And there's no way to fathom what happens is these kids, it's gruesome, but it's been said a few times right here on this station by national broadcasters. They had their head shot off. And Mark, that just should not happen in a civilized society. And these guns, these high-powered guns, you can do that in a matter of minutes, if not seconds.
Well, it is, it should not happen in a civilized society, but it does. Yes, it is.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're civilized and my neighbor in the Garden District. Mark Bauer, thank you, sir. Always a pleasure.
All right, thank you.
First Financial Tax Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for our program.